Controversy builds over possible new development on Georgia's Cumberland Island. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. And just ahead, our First Coast Connect book club takes a look at Cumberland Island as we also look at a controversial proposal to build on the pristine barrier island. Get on the line now and let us know what you think at 549-2937. Then later, why some say they're alarmed at some of the nominees being submitted to join President-elect Trump's cabinet. Plus, our own commentator Jay Solomon talks about his time with astronaut and Senator John Glenn. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, controversy on Cumberland Island. The pristine spot, the largest and southernmost of Georgia's barrier islands, is known for its wild horses and the near total lack of development along its beautiful seashore. Cumberland first became a protected national seashore back in 1972. Now, the island is accessible only by ferry or private boat, and it served as the famous location of the wedding of John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette in 1996. But now, descendants of the island's first wealthy owners, among them Carnegies, have put forth a proposal to build some new homes on Cumberland. This is alarming environmentalists who argue the island needs to stay just as it is, one of the few truly wild spots along the eastern seaboard. With all this controversy as a backdrop, today we decided to lead the show with our First Coast Connect Book Club as we discuss Charles Seabrook's nonfiction work, Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses. Here with more, our book club leader, Stacey Goldring, a strong woman of our very great renown here on the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks. Also with us, Lisa Williams. She's executive board member of the North Florida Sierra Club. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think about a proposal to build on the protected national seashore of Cumberland Island? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. And Stacey, in a minute we'll talk about this book, which is so relevant to the headline about Cumberland Island. But first, Lisa Williams, the Camden County Zoning Board just had a meeting about allowing some rezoning on the island to allow for descendants of the Carnegie family, the original landholder, to subdivide and build. Can you explain quickly why this is so controversial?
Well, first thing I'd like to say is I'm part of the North Florida group, so I'm not privy to a lot of the information going on in that area. But from what I know, the thing we need to recall is that in 1982, 9,000 acres of Cumberland were set up as wilderness designation. And so as a wilderness designation, that's one of the highest levels of protection there is. So that's where the controversy mainly ensues. We've got wilderness that covers most of the island, although in 2004, some of that wilderness area was taken out of wilderness, which is a sad precedent to be setting. So this development is going to, well, we hope, it has already passed a meeting of the Planning Commission at this point, but there will still be opportunities to intervene. But at this point, they have gotten a variance to develop, to start the process. Yes, they do not have the paved road that they needed to have, and they received a variance to allow it to go ahead.
So with that as a backdrop, Stacey, your book for today is Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses. This is a nonfiction narrative by Charles Seabrook, and he wrote it as a metaphor for the constant push and pull that we face in trying to find a harmonious balance between man and nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do consider the book a metaphor, wouldn't you, Lisa? I mean, if you think about it, it's interesting because, you know, in literature we have man versus man versus society, man versus himself. Well, we have the same thing happening in nature. We have nature versus man, which is happening on Cumberland Island, nature versus itself when we have plants fighting it out for photosynthesis, because basically that's what it's all about. And then we have nature versus nature, where we have invasives fighting the natural. So now we have to define what's native and natural versus the invasive. And in the case of Man versus Nature, which is the book Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses, really Cumberland Island and this book, and Seabrook does a really good job. He is a former newspaper journalist. You remember what newspapers were? They were these wonderful things you'd get in the morning, and you'd have a cup of coffee, and you would read unbiased news, and it was, you know, it's just, you know, a remembrance of things past, as Proust would say. But anywho, so in this book, really what Seabrook presents to you as a reader is what you do with nature has an effect. What you choose to do with your environment has an effect. So in the case of Cumberland Island, we have people who have lived there. Right,
and there are people living there today.
Yes, they are.
We need to be clear. There are homes on the island today.
They have inherited that land, coming down from the Carnegie family,
right,
and the Coca-Cola family. I think it's the Candler family. So we have people that this is part of their identity.
Sure.
This is part of who they are. But then you have the wilderness, and that is who they are. That is their identity. So now go ahead and balance that and find harmony. And here's a spoiler alert. It's never going to happen. There's always a push me, pull me. What we have to do is be smart in our preservation and smart in our conservation. Two very different things.
And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937. It's our book club today as we focus on Charles Seabrook's Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses. In a moment, I want to ask you what he means by strong women in the book. Let me ask you, Lisa, this book is a fabulous way for people to get into Stacy's book club. Our partner, the Jacksonville Public Library, will have copies of this book for people to check out and be part of the club, the virtual club. In a moment, we'll tell you how you can be part of Stacy's physical book club, which meets every month at the San Marco Bookstore. But with all of that said, as Stacy pointed out, there are homes on the island. So why is it such a big deal to build? It looks like there could be as many as 10 more.
Mm-hmm. This subdivision looks like it would be a subdivision of 10 homes. The thing we need to recall is that nature provides us with many ecosystem services if we leave it alone. We've got fresh water that's cleaned through nature. We've got stormwater services. We've got all kinds of services that nature provides. When we start developing, then we need to start providing these services. And besides the fact that you alter the whole idea of what wilderness is, wilderness is supposed to be man untrammeled by man and nature.
And you keep the earth more healthy, the more biodiversity you have, and you let nature just do its thing. When we start to engage in it in an unbalanced, and the key word here is balanced, way, that's when you end up with erosion. I mean, we saw what happened, you know, down in on the St. John's River after Hurricane Matthew, with so many people losing because they built the bulkheads instead of letting the natural grasses, et cetera, go ahead and absorb that erosion, et cetera. So
exactly.
you've got to be smart in how you develop. You really do.
And Cumberland evokes such strong emotions because it's one of the only places anywhere along the eastern seaboard where you can walk the beach and see nothing but sand and
dunes. That's what Lisa was saying. I've never been there,
and
this is stunning.
It really is. I've only had the opportunity to take the ferry over there one time. But
I'd love to go.
The minute you get off the ferry, you see wild horses walking around. They're feral. They won't allow
feral.
You to touch
right.
them. They're
right.
feral.
Right.
The National Park Service will explain that they are not fed. They are not taken care of. Nature is allowed to take its course. So the only horses on that island that survive, they're just eating the grass on the ground. Nobody's coming over to feed those horses. It is a truly wild place.
Right.
And so it's so unusual anywhere on the East Coast to see that. I think that's why this is evoking such strong passion.
And even the idea that you are going to the horses. The horses are an invasive species.
Yeah.
As well as the hogs. And a little bit the armadillo, wouldn't
hogs.
You say?
Yeah.
But what the horses are not supposed to be there. They were introduced by the Spanish in the 1500s. So,
and
you know,
that's
you have
why
to
they
decide.
Don't. And they don't do anything to keep them
no,
alive.
No, and they are not well. They are not
they're
looking
not,
good.
Yeah, they didn't look good.
No, and they're eating the spartina, which is so important for erosion, biodiversity, for animals, breeding ground. And so the horses are not where they're supposed to be. The hogs certainly aren't where they're supposed to be. So the question is, now that they've been there since the 1500s, that's a long time. Do you get rid of them? Do you not get rid of them? So this is incredible.
The
and P.S., the horses, a little bit of marketing, because how romantic is that? People have loved horses since like the first book, a.k.a. cave paintings. So we have this draw. It's very tricky.
Well, and beyond just the spartina, which holds the marsh intact, and if without spartina grasses, we lose the marsh, which is where the so much productivity occurs, and we get our crabs and everything else, the shrimp and everything finds a home in a marsh. But beyond that, there you've got the feral hogs who are eating the loggerhead eggs and the shorebird eggs, which are all endangered species themselves. So we run into that issue.
And as we talk about the controversy on Cumberland Island, environmentalists are digging in their heels against her proposal to build on the protected national seashore. It's also our first Coast Connect book club today. Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses by Charles Seabrook. More about how you can read that book with Stacy in a moment. But right now, let's go to your calls. 549-2937. What do you think about this proposal? What are your questions about Cumberland Island? Justin in St. Mary's, Georgia. Hi, Justin. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Grew up coming to Cumberland, and my children come to Cumberland, and it's one of the most amazing places I think I've ever been in the world. But with this issue, I find it somewhat concerning, and it seems to be painting with a pretty broad brush that the Carnegie family is the one family I feel that's really donated, say, 90% of the island and made it a national park and has nothing to do with the development. And I think when people hear the word development or neighborhood, they've gotten very concerned, and there should be concern. But I think the focus is wrong. It's my understanding from the meeting that it was the Candler family who had purchased the property and was looking to develop it. But the Carnegies, is my understanding, have been amazing stewards of the island, and with Lucy donating most of it to the national park. And when we speak about development in Cumberland, I would really venture to say this is my understanding, the least inhabited the island's ever been.
Justin, first of all, I want to know what is so beautiful about Cumberland. I've never been, and everyone just seems to get in this trance-like state when they... What is that magic?
It's inexplicable. I think you really have to be there to understand it. From traveling the world, Africa, Asia, South America.
Really? All those places? That's remarkable to me.
Is Cumberland Island.
So close. And we, you know?
And you're lucky that you live so close by and you can visit whenever you want.
I mentioned the Carnegies because if we go back to the book, Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses, the Carnegies play a major role in the history of man in the book. I mean, we go back to the Timucuan Indians, but unfortunately we don't have a lot written about them, but we know that they were an important presence. And then moving forward, we have the Spanish and the French, et cetera. But the Carnegie, that's why I mentioned them. But please know that I'm being very balanced, but I must, you know, discuss what the book is about. And it's fascinating, the Carnegies. I learned so much.
Yeah.
You run into everyone on this island. It's remarkable.
And
it's a who's who.
And Justin, thanks for pointing that out. That's Justin from St. Mary's, Georgia. Lisa, as he points out, there are two families, the descendants of these two Gilded Age families who have a vested interest in the island. The Cumberland family and the Candler family. Can you talk a little bit about what he had to say? And this is in the book, too, as well.
Yes, they are. They're more on the northern side, right?
I'm not real clear on all of that. I do know that the Carnegies are a large family, and some of them wanted it protected as national park, and Lucy did work really hard to do that. But she did not sell her property to the park, and so she retains her rights there, that for Grayfield Inn. And the same with the Candlers. They did not sell to the park, as far as I know. So they're permanent residents.
And these permanent residents, it's my understanding, they have an agreement with the National Park Service that they can live on the island.
Yeah, kind of until you know, the last one kind of, you know, leaves this beautiful place. And then it goes back to the National Park Service.
But if new homes go in, now, would that cause a wrinkle?
Well, that's in perpetuity. Then they would be able to stay. But, you know, it reminds me of like a mixed marriage. You know, you have one side that is, you know, they want to do it one way. The other side doesn't like it. And then you have the poor National Park Service, who's like the aunt who decided to have Thanksgiving at her house. And she knows everyone is fighting. No one likes the turkey, indigestion from the stuffing. So, you know, there's no way to make everyone happy. So what we have to do, and what the book points out, is it's going to be about balance. But in the end, you know, it's called Strong Women, Wild Horses.
Who are the strong women, by the way?
Well, we go back to the Timucuan women, who made a wonderful culture there as caregivers. And then from there, we go to Dona Maria Melendez, who was responsible for converting a lot of the Timucuan into Christianity. And then we have Katie Green Miller. We have Zabette, who is a slave, who ends up having wonderful, like a whole bunch of kids who end up being like super smart. One ends up being a countess in Paris. And there is an opera written about this woman.
And she was married to Stafford.
Yeah.
Yes, who owned the plantation.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our first Coast Connect book club today on the show.
I think it should be a Downton Abbey. Someone out there should be a filmmaker, and really they should make this happen, because then I would review it.
You would. And the book is Charles Seabrook's Cumberland Island, Strong Women, Wild Horses. Why are we leading with the book club? Because there's controversy on Cumberland Island about whether to develop part of it with new construction. 549-2937. Peter in Jacksonville Beach. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, good morning. I would like to ask what future and present residents of the island do for utilities, electricity, water, sewer, telephone, etc.
Utilities on the island. I do think that there are very limited utilities on the island for the homeowners.
I know that Fraser, who was involved at one point, some of the Carnegie descendants sold to Fraser. He was a developer of Hilton Head Island, and he had wanted to develop Cumberland as well. He actually did start development there, but was unable to complete because Lucy of Grayfield would not sell to him, so he ended up selling to the Park Service. But he did start the development and put a lot of facilities underground.
Underground is key.
Yeah.
And what's so amazing about when you belong to a book group, and everyone out there really should belong to a book group, is that you will find connections, which I call biblionexu. And in several of my book groups, people are connected either the way Lisa is through her passion for the environment, or we had found out from someone else in our book group about the underground building, so that of the utilities, so that helps out with that. But of course, if you're going to go ahead and have new construction, well, then you're going to have to deal with habitat destruction.
And sewage treatment, and you name it. We've got a lot of issues.
Fire rescue, etc.
Lots of tweets about this controversial development proposal on Cumberland Island. Danny tweets the show, development on Cumberland Island? Oh, hell no, he says. Brian tweets the show, my thanks to the caller Justin, who pointed out the Candlers are selling, but the Carnegies are cooperative preservationists. So is the Candler family selling their acres so that they can be developed?
I don't think they're selling them. I think they are just asking for a variance
to build.
Yeah. Yes.
And Mark Woods,
that's my understanding,
columnist at the Florida Times Union, tweets the show, this development would be near Sea Camp, right in the heart of Cumberland Island. So for people to get a mental picture, Stacy, it is the largest,
it's like
barrier.
Manhattan.
Yeah, it's picture Manhattan Island, but it's a wilderness off the coast of southern Georgia.
Right, so it's a barrier island.
It's their biggest barrier island in the Georgia Golden Isles.
Right.
And the only one that is not developed.
Right. And when you talk about strong women, one we really do need to mention, besides strong women sitting around this table, let's be honest, is Mother Nature and climate change. And we may be talking about Cumberland Island, the whole thing may be moot because, you know, 30, 50 years from now with sea rise, you know, we can do everything to protect the loggerheads. We can do everything to get the feral hogs out of there. But we may be underwater.
In the short term, though, what's the next step in this battle over whether to develop on the island, Lisa?
Well, I'm from what I read, there's going to you can it can be appealed, and you would go to the Camden County Commission, maybe go to their website if you're interested in pursuing this. I know that Wilderness, I think there's a group called wildcumberland.org. They're very involved in this, and they can give you information.
And when you look at the websites online, every website you go to presents a completely different Cumberland Island. It's like Cumberland Island, the schizophrenic. You know, you have one that looks like something like out of a Polo magazine. It's gorgeous. It's romantic. It's sepia tone. And then you have the other one where it's, you know, oh my God, they're killing the baby turtles. And then you have poor National Park Service, government, or and they have like sad 1999 looking website. So, you know, what people have to leave this conversation knowing is remember that when you read books, you become more aware of, you connect with the world around you. You have this experience where you all of a sudden become sensitive and you have enlightenment to what's happening in your, in this case, in your community. And it's a fascinating book. It's about strong women and it's about not so strong men, unfortunately. They're not feeling so good. And there was a lot of alcoholism, slavery, yes, cronyism, a little titanium mining was tried, a little tongue tree plantation was tried. You know, they tried a lot of things, but really we're talking about Lucy Coleman Carnegie, who wanted all of her children around her. So she built little cottages. We would call mansions.
They're
for
mansions.
Them to live,
oh yeah,
for
I've
them
seen
to
them.
Live. So you know,
yeah,
she wanted it, it. This is a book. You know, in a way, it's a book about family. And here's the result: when you are a matriarch, you know, again, strong women.
The book is Charles Seabrook's Cumberland Island Wild Horses. Be part of Stacy's and the First Coast Connect Book Club. You can check out extra copies at the Jacksonville Public Library. They are our book club partner, and you can meet Stacy this Thursday night. She's going to do what she calls a Blix. That's a book that was made into a movie. Tell us about the Blix screening at the San Marco Bookstore. It's this Thursday.
It is. It is. I'm very excited. We are going to talk about the book and screen the film, A Christmas Memory. And this book is an early piece of writing by the amazing Truman Capote. And so we're going to look at this film and talk a little bit about the book, which actually, the book is actually a compilation. First of all, isn't it beautiful? It's like the perfect Christmas gift. It's so beautiful. And it's about Truman reflecting on growing up. We know it happens in Monroeville, although he doesn't say it. And it's really just a day with his elderly cousin, and they're making fruitcake. Now, I know that might sound super boring, but when you're in the hands of a good writer, you can, like, breathe and be riveted. So just trust me on this one. It is so beautiful. And the film, it was made into a film three times. And we are going to look at the original with Geraldine Page. It was also made into a film with Patty Duke, and also Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, but, made three times.
Yeah.
Well, it must be a
but
good story then.
We're going to the original.
So come on out and meet Stacy. It's Thursday night, 7 p.m. at the San Marco Bookstore. First, a discussion of Truman Capote's book, A Christmas Memory, then a screening of the film.
It'll be fun.
And be part of the First Coast Connect Book Club by listening every month and checking out the books Stacy recommends. Thanks so much for being with us. Also here, Lisa Williams of the North Florida Sierra Club. Ladies, thanks a lot.
Thank you,
Melissa.
Well, later, how a local physician is breaking barriers on the First Coast. But up next, why some activists are raising concern about Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
When you're experiencing the in-depth content of WJCT, you know there's always something more to explore, regardless of the device. It's a special commitment sharing the world, and as such, WJCT is an indispensable service here on the First Coast. Truth is, however, that such content, whether you access it via television, radio, or various digital platforms, is expensive. Costs that are largely funded by people like you. So please, during this season of giving, stand up now for your cherished values of curiosity and excellence with your vital year-end investment. Your support makes it possible for WJCT to continue to share your community, your world. Do so today at WJCT.org. Thank you.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Get the latest news about WJCT programming information, highlights, and events with the WJCT e-newsletter. Go to WJCT.org and sign up today. WJCT. Log on. Find out.
Welcome back. Well, President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet is taking shape, pending Senate confirmation. This morning, he announced ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as his choice for Secretary of State. Some have raised concern about Tillerson's close ties to Russia. And some of Trump's other picks are also causing eyebrows to be raised. With more on that, we welcome Dr. Parvez Ahmed of UNF's Kagan College of Business. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And to our callers, what are your thoughts and questions about Donald Trump, President-elect Trump's cabinet picks? It's 549-2937 to join the conversation. Well, this morning, Rex Tillerson is all the discussion, as Trump has indicated he would like Tillerson to be his Secretary of State. There are other picks, though, that have caught attention. In particular, Dr. Ben Carson is the nominee for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. You are concerned about this choice. Why?
I'm concerned about many of the choices. First of all, Trump ran and won on a populist agenda. And if you look at his cabinet, it is anything but a populist cabinet. It is filled with establishment. Anybody who thinks Rex Tillerson is not an establishment figure needs to get their head examined. But I think the concern of different picks are different. For example, with Rex Tillerson, the concern is his ties with Russia, his lack of foreign policy experience, although he has been negotiating, but negotiating on behalf of Exxon and negotiating on behalf of the interest of the American people are two different things. On the nomination of other cabinet members like Ben Carson, Jeff Sessions, his national security advisor Michael Flynn, or the nominee for the CIA director Mike Pompeo, they have expressed quite a bit alarming views about Islam and Muslims, and some of those views may translate into policy, and some of those views may just be just opinions, but that's the whole problem with this whole Trump transition, is so much of it is uncertain. So much of it is clouded in how does his statements and the statements of some of his cabinet choice translate into public policy remains a concern.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the cabinet taking place under President-elect Donald Trump. Now, when it comes to retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson, in particular, some of his comments about Islam have concerned you and other Islamic academics and activists. He has called what he said the danger of a civilizational jihad against the U.S., wherein jihadists who disguise themselves as moderate Muslims would infiltrate, multiply, and take positions of power in order to replace our Judeo-Christian values with Islam. This is a largely debunked conspiracy theory promoted by the Center for Security Policy. the Southern Poverty Law Center considers that organization to be a hate group. And so are you, is it your belief that Dr. Ben Carson is espousing hateful and inaccurate theories?
Ben Carson is one of them. Michael Flynn is another one. Michael Flynn said Islam is a political ideology based on religion. So if you take all of these views into account, you are getting into the territory where administration can whip a frenzy. I mean, he did that during the run-up to the election and during his campaign, targeting a vulnerable minority. And if you really view that Islam is not a religion, then of course mosques and Muslims are not afforded their First Amendment protections. And then you start going down a slippery slope. Then you begin to mainstream the idea of a Muslim registry or a total ban on Muslims coming to the United States or surveillance of mosques. That's the kind of danger that we are in. And of course, at this moment in time, we do not have clarity as to what do these statements mean in terms of policy prescriptions. And I hope during the confirmation hearing of some of these cabinet positions, Michael Flynn will not come up for confirmation hearing as a national security advisor, so there's no confirmation for that. But Ben Carson and Jeff Sessions and Mike Pompeo will come up for confirmation hearing. And I'm hoping that some of these issues do get play. People are asked questions about it because it is not just for the interest of the Muslim community. You know, there are reports from the Southern Poverty Law Center that in 10 days after the election, there were 900 incidents of hate crimes. 300 of those incidents were done in the name of Donald Trump. There were some incidents that were anti-Trump also, but they were small. 23 of those incidents, anti-Trump incidents, were also recorded. And what has dismayed me is that while Trump has tweeted about Hamilton, about Saturday Night Live, the New York Times, he has not said a single word about the rise of hate crimes. And when you think about hate crimes, we should all always be concerned about crime in general. But hate crimes are even more dangerous. That's why there's a separate federal statute against hate crimes, is because hate crimes create, it's like terrorism. Because it not only victimizes the victim that it is targeting, but it instills a sense of fear within large population. That's the danger we are in. And to see that the next president is not saying a word about it is very, very disconcerting.
You recently attended a meeting in New York where the top Muslim and the top Jewish leaders of this country got together. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, I mean, we did. I mean, I'm part of a year-long educational process called the Muslim Leadership Initiative that is sponsored by the Shalom Hartman Institute based out of Jerusalem and New York. And in that educational fellowship that I just completed this last summer, I went through a one-year process of learning about Judaism, Judaism and the Jewish people. So as part of that continuation of the process, we got together with a bunch of Jewish leaders in New York, literally 3 or 4 days after the election. And the conversation was quite palpable. It is, you know, obviously the Muslim community is alarmed and concerned, partly because of the rhetoric that Donald Trump had deployed during the election. But the Jewish community is also equally alarmed and concerned because of Steve Bannon, the rise of alt-right, which is really a euphemism for white supremacy and neo-Nazi ideas. The fact that these ideas are now mainstream, these people with these ideas are part of the White House, is a tremendous concern. And I honestly do not see a level of concern and a level of outrage that legitimately should be there. I mean, think about it, that in Austria, they had a recent election, and Austria rejected the far right. The alt-right is in the White House. I mean, we liberated a continent from the Nazis. And here we are dealing with the phenomena in completely reverse. In less than 100 years, it seems like the tables have turned the other direction. And that's a concern, and I do not see enough conversation about it, enough citizen outrage about it, and I do not see enough effective organized protest against it.
But that, all of that said, you foresee the two groups that met in New York banding together, which wouldn't normally we might see in this country, to speak out against the normalization of hate speech.
Right. I mean, of course, the Jewish community worldwide, but also in the United States, has faced the scourge of anti-Semitism longer than the Muslim community has faced the scourge of Islamophobia. So from the Muslim community's perspective, there's a lot to learn from our Jewish brothers and sisters. And that was one of the purposes, to kind of think about what could be lessons that we could adopt and learn, but also where we could work with each other to put forward a common front against this problem. But realistically speaking, both the Jewish community and the Muslim community are small minorities in this country. It will have to take the effort of the majority to stop this kind of a phenomenon.
And given that the Senate is in Republican hands and they advise and consent on these selections, it is likely, one would think, that most of President-elect Trump's choices for his cabinet will be confirmed.
It is very likely, and I don't expect, and personally, I'll tell you my personal thought. On one hand, I think the Senate, particularly the Democrats in the Senate, should raise legitimate questions about the nominees. But I think there is a tradition of giving deference to the president for their nominees. Where the Democrats and people of goodwill, including Republicans, should band together is on the policy questions. I'm less interested in particular views of the nominees, although they do inform what possible policies may be coming down the pike. But I think we should all concentrate on what are the policy issues. You know, this idea that he had talked about a Muslim registry or a ban on Muslims or deporting the Dreamers, deporting a large number of undocumented immigrants, a wall on our southern border, the so-called reset with Russia, violating the One China policy. What do that mean? What does that mean? And I think the American public needs to know that if there is this sudden change, whether in American foreign policy or in our domestic policy, what would it actually mean for us as ordinary citizens?
What about the emerging school of thought that a lot of what Donald Trump talked about on the campaign trail is not actually now going, that a lot of these campaign promises and these incredibly inflammatory statements may not actually be the way he governs, that, for example, his calls to prosecute Hillary Clinton, now that he's been elected, he's backed away from that.
Right.
Building a wall on the southern border has become, well, perhaps we'll build a fence, even and just in a few spots along the border. So we see this rhetoric giving way to walking back quite a few of the statements that drew the most controversy during the campaign.
And you worry about it both ways. You worry about if those policies, if those rhetoric indeed become policies, in some sense that would be the worst case scenario. In some sense, the success of his rhetoric would be the worst case scenario. But on the other hand, I also worry that if he backtracks on those promises, then what happens to his supporters? How do they react? There is a palpable anger and fear across American society, whether they are Donald Trump supporters, whether they are Donald Trump detractors. What is necessary is not just a president, but a political process that begins to bridge that divide, begins to heal the wounds. And I'm not sure if Donald Trump is capable of doing that. If he follows through with his policies, the divide would become worse. If he backtracks on his policies, the divide would continue to play out. Does he have the wisdom, does he have the statesmanship to pull us out of this problem? So far, the evidence suggests the contrary.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Dr. Parvez Ahmed of UNF's Kagan College of Business. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some critics of President-elect Trump say his agenda and leadership style bear a troubling similarity to fascist leaders of the 1900s. The history of fascism and its relevance to U.S. politics today at 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Eddie Palmieri and Harlem River Drive.
And my problem with Harlem River Drive is that I wanted a crossover. And you know who were my biggest fans? The anti-government movement, the Weathermen.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, the death of pioneering astronaut and American icon John Glenn last week stirred memories for many. Glenn will lie in state at the Ohio Statehouse Rotunda in Columbus Friday. Then he'll be celebrated Saturday in a memorial service at the university as well. For our occasional commentator, Jay Solomon, who as a reporter sometimes covered Glenn, it all brought back a special moment. He shares it now in today's edition of With All Due Respect.
If the big highlight of John Glenn's life had only been World War II, it would have been enough. After Pearl Harbor, he left college and his small-town Ohio roots to join the service, eventually becoming a Marine pilot, logging 59 combat flights and being hit by anti-aircraft fire five times. If he had only his experience in Korea, that would have been enough. He flew 90 missions, attracting so much flack, he earned a nickname based on his posterior being magnetic. Twice missions ended with more than 250 holes in his aircraft. Those airborne exploits earned a multitude of honors, including 6 Distinguished Flying Crosses and 18 Air Medal Awards. If John Glenn's achievements were limited to his exploits as a test pilot, it would have been enough. Leading that list is being the first pilot to make a transcontinental flight at supersonic speed, positioning him on the path to being among the first picked for NASA's astronaut program. Although test pilot successes attracted attention, it was being the first American to orbit the Earth that made him an icon in 1962. If that's all he had done, it would have been enough. And if Glenn had only his successful and respected 24-year post-military political career as Ohio's longest-serving senator, that certainly would have been enough. Someone with such a resume might be expected to become, let's say, above it all. Well, perhaps when flying. Otherwise, his feet were solidly on the ground. I was a radio news director in Columbus, Ohio, when Glenn won his Senate seat. I was still actively reporting and met him at a news conference in his office. In brief, he was a nice guy then, and I never saw that change. He answered questions thoughtfully. He seemed to enjoy the process. He did protect his private life and was especially protective of his wife, Annie, who was a stutterer. So it was surprising when the Glens asked about 12 of us, reporters and spouses, to dinner at their home one evening. Sitting on a river, their stone and wood home was warm, comfortable, and in no way ostentatious. There was no hint of his fame. Until Annie asked us to drop our coats in a spare bedroom. As we entered the hallway, we were engulfed by spectacular photography, stunning pictures from outer space. The night was chilly, so the senator gathered us around his fireplace as he lit a fire. Suddenly, there was a commotion. Smoke was filling the room. The war hero astronaut senator had forgotten to open the flue to the chimney. A common sort of man to the core, a bit embarrassed, but laughing at himself as he and Annie worked to clear the air. It was a nice evening, perhaps not especially memorable, except for the man and his wife who made us feel like old friends. The man and his wife who were still sweethearts after some 70 years of marriage at his death last week. And I'm guessing, of all his accomplishments, to him, that was the one that mattered most. With all due respect, I'm Jay Solomon.
Jay Solomon, a retired broadcast executive and WJCT volunteer. Well, finally this hour, she has broken a barrier as the first African-American woman to become president of the Duval County Medical Society. Trishella Johnson Foy, MD, was installed as the 130th president of the society last week at their inaugural ball. Foy is a board-certified family physician on the north side, and she is no stranger to overcoming obstacles. Dr. Foy, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank and congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's a big deal. And all the kudos to you, the first woman, African-American woman, to lead this important organization in Jacksonville, the Duval County Medical Society. How exciting is this to assume this role for you?
It's beyond exciting. It's an opportunity to really be a force in our community for people to kind of see a different face of medicine, to be a part of the Jacksonville community, which I was born and raised. And so right around the corner, Rebalt High School, to be a graduate and for people to see what can come out of any neighborhood and the success that I have achieved in this short period of time, I'm really appreciative to be able to really just be the face of medicine right now. So
yeah. And as you said, it's been an incredible journey for you. You grew up in Jacksonville, got your undergraduate degree from Florida, your medical degree from Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. But you grew up in difficult circumstances, correct?
Yes, yes. It was one of those things, people think of the difficulty being poverty, and poverty is easy. Both of my parents, unfortunately, faced and battled addictions as I was growing up, so I had to become an adult at a very young age and really learn how to take care of myself. And as a part of that, I was fortunate enough, though, along the way to have many people come around who saw something in me, who encouraged me to kind of stay the path, who told me that I could do and be anything. And I bought into that idea. I was distracted at times by the circumstances. I was distracted by, you know, the things that you deal with in underserved neighborhoods, the poverty, the, you know, not being able to eat or sleep or because of gunshots. Different things, but to really believe that I wasn't defined by those circumstances was something that once I realized that and believed that God had something greater for me to do, it became really easy. The circumstances, I always felt that other people were going through something tougher and that the days could always be worse. And because I truly believed that, it made this idea of coming out of it really easy.
Those mentors really reached back to provide you the support you needed at a critical time.
Yes.
Growing up, it's my understanding, in a crack house where you saw people dying all around you, did you at one point become suicidal yourself? Or did it get so bad that you thought, I can't go on and realize my dreams?
So I guess I didn't completely see people dying around me in a crack house. So let's clarify that. But in the general sense, the purpose is they were killing themselves spiritually, emotionally, and yes, physically. And so when I was 13 years old and really had a great awareness of, oh my goodness, these are my circumstances, I didn't feel like my life mattered in those moments. And so spiritually, I was suicidal. And I felt like I didn't have a purpose in this world. And so because I didn't have a purpose, then I didn't need to be here. And so I started asking God, you know, to not let me wake up, because things were terrible to, you know, see your mother going through her struggles, to see pretty much everybody around you living in a life that just was of complete despair, you know, to be kind of pseudo homeless, because we really were living in the neighborhood crack house. And, you know, I carried buckets of water down the street to bathe in ice cold water. To this day, I can't really stand the touch of cold water on my skin because it just takes me back there sometimes. And so in those moments, yes, I was full of despair. I was full of I lost hope, but I didn't want to kill myself because I was also very just spiritual and knew and felt that, you know, if you do that, you couldn't go to heaven. And so I was living a hell on earth and didn't feel like I wanted to continue that. So as I continued to wake up every single day, despite saying, God, just let me sleep, I had to say, well, why am I waking up every day? And it was in those moments I tapped into this idea that I had a divine purpose, that I woke up every day because God had something for me to do, because I was meant to bring something more to this world, to make a grand impact, to really be of use and of service, and to do more and to grow beyond this, and that this was just training, that this was a setup for some circumstances later that would maybe even more challenging. And so because of that, waking up and being in their circumstances became easier. Waking up and seeing those things around me, because the circumstances didn't change. My attitude about them changed. And because my attitude about them changed, that's why I'm sitting before you now.
It's an incredible story, and we're so pleased to welcome you to the program. And congratulations on this new appointment. Keep in touch with us, please.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.
She is Trichella Johnson Foy, MD, the 130th president of the Duval County Medical Society. Dr. Johnson Foy is a board-certified family physician on the North Side, an assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Family Medicine for UF College of Medicine in Jacksonville. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app. And next on Diane Rehm, a look at President-elect Trump's agenda and leadership style, why some say it bears a troubling similarity to fascist leaders of the past century, the history of fascism and its relevance to U.S. politics today. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.